just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all, you never saw been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straightening the curves, yeah, flattening the hills. Someday the mountain might get them, but the law never will. Making their way the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow.
And welcome to another episode of Back, the crazy sports history podcast, where we talk about everything that you don't hear about in the conventional world of sports media. With me, I'm your host, Brandon Richardson, and with me is my co-host, Mr. Matt O'Brien.
That is correct. I am Hurricane Matt, here with my buddy, Tropical Storm Brandon, and we are going to bring you another episode, and I think this is going to be a good one.
Right, and like, so this is not, like, okay, we say that we're, you know, a little-known sports history podcast, and that we go into the stories that maybe you don't always hear about. Not always the case that we're going to stick to that. So we try to find the things that we don't necessarily know about, and this is the case where this is the subject that I'm sure maybe a lot of our listeners will know about, but we really kind of we're neophytes to the world of what we're going to talk about.
Absolutely. We are going to sort of be going through the origins and the rise of the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, also known as NASCAR, an American institution. And yeah, we very casual fans of NASCAR growing up, I guess you could call us. Familiar with some of the personalities,
sure,
and some of the, you know, traditions, obviously the Daytona 500, which we will get into.
Hating Jeff Gordon.
Yep.
Proud NASCAR tradition of hating hating Jeff Gordon, which I was like, something I heard growing up. I mean, I knew that all people around, which I grew up out in the country, around country people, and I knew that everyone around me hated Jeff Gordon, but I didn't really know why until we did this podcast.
Yeah, and we heard one of the great lines from the show King of the Hill is, I believe, was it Bill Deltry that said, I could have been a race car driver too if I had a rich daddy to buy a car for me.
I think it was Bill, and you know what, the guy's a talented driver, and I'm kind of talking tongue-in-cheek, but I have become, I'm sure, and I think you have too, we talked about this a little before we started, a legit, okay, I don't want to say like I'm a diehard NASCAR fan, but I am legitimately interested, new fan to the sport of NASCAR. I couldn't be more into it now after a week of watching what might be the most documented sport in all of sports history.
Yeah, truly insane how, if you go on YouTube and type in NASCAR documentary, you are just a whole ocean of oil will be under your feet.
The deepest rabbit hole on the internet. And Illuminati videos and stuff like nothing. There's a video for everything that's ever happened in NASCAR.
Every driver, every race track, every, you name it, man. It's and so for those of you who are listening that may be fans of NASCAR, bear with us because, yeah, as I said, we are casual fans. We have been doing our homework, and we want to pay the sport the respect it deserves because it is
absolutely
some crazy shit.
This is our earnest best attempt at you know, covering the rise of NASCAR, and we hope it meets with your approval because we sure love your sport.
Yeah, and so hopefully if you guys joined us last week, you heard us talk about the origins of another crazy-ass American sport, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, We had a lot of fun researching that and covering that, and we thought, how are we going to top the excitement of studying that and get into something else? But
it seemed impossible. It seemed like, what could possibly fire you up more? And we said NASCAR. I said, okay, cool. We'll check it out. Man. Couldn't be more fired up. So without any further ado, let's get into it. So, Matt, it all began in the frigid streams of the Scottish Highlands and the farmsteads of rural Ireland, in the land of peasant farmers and dirt-poor laborers. It was a hard, unforgiving world, a culture based on independence, self-reliance, hard work, staunch faith, good humors, and short tempers, all of which might be familiar to you if you're of that heritage. The cool, clear water from those streams would be used to produce a stiff drink for a rugged people, more elixir than beverage. It would become a linchpin in the Scotch-Irish culture, homemade whiskey. Now, a penchant for booze combined with a fierce independent streak does not lend itself well to being a servant to the British crown. So many Scotch-Irish made the transatlantic journey to the British from the British colonies to the they made the transatlantic journey to the British colonies in America in an effort to put as much distance between themselves and the King of England as possible. Which, I mean, what do you say? I mean, you're saying, what does this have to do with NASCAR? It has everything to do with NASCAR, right?
Absolutely. It has everything to do with everything.
It has everything to do with everything. By the time 1776 had rolled around, many of them had decided that they were simply sick and tired of King George's horseshit. And over the course of the next few years, they and their fellow citizens proceeded to make life so miserable for the British Army that they somehow, some way, managed to drive out the most powerful nation in the world at the time, anyways, not anymore, and secure their independence. Can I get an amen?
Oh, we sure did.
Hell yeah, we did.
General Washington.
Thank you, President Washington. Yes, sir. Thank you again.
Obviously, everybody who was down to scrap and
it's like your post-fight press conference for the American Revolution. I think my strength and conditioning coach, Sam Adams.
Yeah.
My boxing coach, Jefferson.
And that revolutionary spirit, that crazy, that wild side can definitely be felt with some of the descendants of the revolutionaries in the sport of NASCAR.
Right, because we're talking about, like, yeah, we're, you know, the everyone knows the founding fathers and everything, but that's really the, if we will, like, the 1%, right? So it's the top of the, they were the generals and the politicians, but the guys that, like, shouldered the brunt of the fighting were the people. A lot of them were the Scotch-Irish heritage, and after the war, they decided to move even further away into the west and to the south. And the Appalachian Mountains, where they settled in the mountains and the pines, they brought their devout Protestants. It's a tough word to say, Protestants. That's why,
Protestantism.
Protestantism. Yeah, work on that. Their strident work ethic and their penchant for
their love for Jesus Christ. That's all you got to say, brother.
I get it. But come on, guys. Enough with the Protestantism already. What are we protesting? Their strident work ethic and their attention for self-reliance, forging close-knit communities in rural areas, often far removed from any state, much less federal jurisdiction. And, of course, they brought their whiskey. But soon, corn became the main ingredient, as it was much less, it was much readier in supply in the U.S. than barley or rye had been back in Scotland and Northern Ireland. And as the settlers were not necessarily known for their patience, aging whiskey in large wooden casks it could take up a lot of time. Then the cask could often be put to better use, you know, collecting water around the homestead. So they didn't really spend a whole lot of time aging it.
Yeah, and we, a little backstory on us, me and Brandon used to live in a house in Chico, California, and we actually had a shed with a – $500 hot tub, a fridge that could hold a keg of beer, and a still where we could make our own rum.
And we didn't need nothing else.
And we got along just fine.
And we were also not particularly concerned with aging the rum that we made. I mean, damn, I remember you'd take like one or two sips of that shit and you'd be off on a rocket ship till 2 a.m.
Yeah, it was pretty potent stuff. And
it was a stiff brew.
And we had some crazy times. I remember one night, our buddy Brian, who actually, he was sort of the mad scientist behind it all. He was a smarty pants, and we were drinking that homemade rum, and there was a raccoon that came across the backyard.
Worst thing that raccoon ever did.
And boy, Brian didn't like
worst
that.
Worst mistake of his life.
No, Brian did not like that. He took, and we're literally in downtown Chico.
We're in the middle of downtown Chico.
Just a stone's throw from the University of Chico State. And Brian pulls out his .22 out of his bedroom, goes into the backyard, draws a bead on that raccoon, takes him down, and then, yeah.
Well, then he brings the raccoon in the house, and he shows everybody his trophy. He was a regular Davy Crockett.
Yeah, we woke up the next morning, and there was raccoon blood all over the place.
So we ain't wild enough to be NASCAR fans. Thank you again, fellas.
So
through feast and famine.
Yeah. I think he used the skin and everything, so it wasn't
he's totally green about it.
Yeah, yeah. Just want to throw that in there.
Hashtag
for all of you animal lovers. Yeah, it was
even
crazy.
A little bit of it, which I would highly recommend against, but
did he do that? Is that right?
He saved a little bit in the fridge, man. There were some raccoon fillets in the fridge.
All right. Well, see, then it was a totally justified kill. So there you go.
That's the farm to table.
Anyways, so, yeah, just making your own liquor at home. It doesn't always work out well.
But still, doesn't mean no reason not to try it.
Yeah.
And you might end up creating a great sport. But we're not telling you to break the law. I'm just telling you. I'm not telling you not to. Throughout feast and famine, through a civil war, reconstruction, and the First World War, you might have heard of those, and are currently rapidly expanding in both scope and power, moonshine was a staple in the American South. Regardless of race, creed, or color, it was a drug of choice for the working class masses, eager for a release from the dawn to dusk work days in the merciless heat and humidity. For many, it was a welcome respite, something like that, on a Saturday night, before spending the next day in church, and if you're of the Protestant bent, that means the entire day. Like, you are in church the entire day on that Sunday. So
yeah,
I was trying to make it easier.
I had the fortune of being raised Catholic, where we get in and out in under an hour.
Like a football practice.
You got a good coach.
Boom, 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 boom. Here's what we do. Sequence by sequence, we're in and out.
And I used to work construction and oil and gas throughout the East Coast. And I one of the places I worked that was the most fascinating was in the hills of West Virginia. And I can tell you that there's still a lot of people there making moonshine to this day. That apple pie moonshine that they make at home is on another level.
Ooh.
And it was absolutely a welcome respite on a Saturday evening after working all week. And I also can tell you that there were some individuals there who would drive like I had never seen. On my way to work one morning, I saw a car go off the road into a ravine, hit a tree, and come back on the road and keep going like nothing had happened.
Oh, that was probably Darryl Waltrip.
Yeah, so the bootlegger is running around. It's yeah.
Well, it wasn't a problem. I mean, you could haul moonshine around, like you could make it and haul it around, and it would be okay until January 20th, 1920. That all went out the window. The 18th Amendment of the United States Constitution effectively established the prohibition of alcoholic beverages in the United States by declaring the production, transport, and sale of alcohol through, though not the consumption of private or possession, illegal. So I guess it means like, that's kind of like, it's not the exact thing that enacted prohibition, right? And the separate Volstead Act is what set down the methods for enforcing the 18th Amendment. And it defined intoxicating liquors that were prohibited and basically defined anything that wasn't like for medical or religious purposes as illegal, which might sound familiar to some of you who use other substances these days.
Yeah, the good old 18th Amendment.
What can we say about that?
Which basically doesn't even exist anymore, or might as well not, obviously, as we all know. But, yeah, that started some shit that changed the world with organized crime, with
yeah, it really just caused all the problems. It doubled down on all the problems that it was trying to correct. You know, it just became a real fiasco.
Yeah,
it led to the rise of organized crime. It led to lots of batches of poison, liquor and poison moonshine, because everything was unregulated.
Yeah.
And it just became a big clusterfuck. It just doesn't seem to work, man. Prohibition just is not the business. So
no,
they're gracious.
I'm not a fan of it.
Not a fan of the prohibition. In their gracious omnipotence, the federal government had decided, because of a few old biddies and a few idiots who went blind drinking brake fluid, that Americans needed to be protected from themselves. However, somehow this backfired, and rather than having its intended effect, the prohibition created a petri dish for black markets to spring up around the country with enterprising purveyors like Joe Kennedy, patriarch of the Kennedy clan, and Al Capone, making fortunes through the illicit import and distribution of alcohol in major cities, which is it's like the El Chapo of their day.
Yeah, and if you've ever seen Boardwalk Empire or those early gangster films that basically chronicle the rise of these dudes as superhuman figures, brought to you by the prohibition of alcohol.
Yeah, no
kidding.
Well, you do see a bit of a kind of, I don't know if it's a class divide is the word I'm looking for, but it's like, well, you saw a couple people get rich in the North, like fewer people get really wealthy. And then in the South, you saw many more people just eke out a subsistence living on the same market, making their own rather than importing it.
Yeah.
Like making their own moonshine. I mean, these are
more of a,
but like very, very poor communities in the South.
More of a farm to table approach to the Southern alcohol trade than.
And right. By,
where smaller communities and farmers could, you know, pass the jug around and, as they would say, if you got a little, you can get a little.
If you got a little, you can get a little. And, I mean, in the rural South, moonshine ruled. Customers needed a way to surreptitiously transport their now illegal product all over the state and through county lines. This led to drivers hauling large loads of moonshine along country back roads, eluding law enforcement from point A to point B as best they could. And this led to more and more souped-up engines with shade tree mechanics modifying cars' stock parts in order to make them more powerful and faster, all in the name of outrunning the law, which is fucking awesome.
Johnny Law, you better put that hammer down.
You better have both them guns ablazing.
Yeah, so we get, and this is kind of where we really start to see all that history sort of lead up to what would really give us sort of the origin of the sport.
Right. So by the 1950s and 60s, I mean, moonshine, at least the you know, surreptitious speeding around the back roads with it, it kind of lost its appeal, because after the prohibition is over, there's not really a whole lot of need to transport it illegally unless you're doing it on like a smaller scale. But it kind of, by the end of the prohibition, it started to decline and at least its popularity and necessity. But it doesn't mean it didn't lead to the classic, you know, whose car is faster than the others. So that became kind of a point of contention in these small towns. And eventually, a lot of these ex-moonshiners banded together, and they began racing in the newly formed National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, which was formed by promoter and reputed bootlegger Bill France in 1947, Bill France is like the godfather of NASCAR.
And the current chairman is Brian France, who...
No relation.
No,
obviously right.
That's what is that? His son?
You know, I think it's his grandson.
Because he took over the position from Bill France Jr. So this is
every detail.
Yeah, this is like I think this is like the grandson. But anyways, I mean, there's not really dynastic rule in any other major American sports league at all. So the France family has basically, you know, taken this from the cradle to where it is now.
Right, and it's dynastic, I mean, but it's earned because it's like they have truly taken it from these back roads to what we've got now. So in 1947, they formed it. By that time, the most popular vehicle that they were using was the one you wanted to get your hands on was the 1940 Ford. It had a 100 horsepower V8 engine that became the car of choice for moonshiners all across the South. Famous drivers were Junior Johnson, Buddy Schumann, Buck Baker. They all learned to drive by outrunning the law on the back roads. They could make about figures kind of vary. Like I've heard as low as like 50, as high as 500, but like an average, it seemed to be about $150 a night. And these people were very, very, very poor. So no one was getting rich. This was a matter of subsistence.
But $150 a night back in the 40s, or what was this? You're saying this is when it was going on, but it would. Hell, that ain't a bad night, you know.
No, it doesn't mean you're doing it every night, though.
And this is, I mean, this is back when a man could make a living before they had helicopters and infrared and all this fancy stuff. They got you, yeah. Now,
goggles.
To imagine just souping your car up and having a working knowledge of the back roads and the in and outs of the country could keep you out of the slammer. It's pretty badass.
Well, there was a federal agent that kept popping up on these interviews and documentaries, Joe Carter. He didn't come off like the sharpest knife in the drawer. He said he went out after this guy night after night, finally got this local moonshiner named Willie Clay Call, who was like, that's the best fucking name for a moonshiner ever. But the local guy, Willie Clay Call, he gets his car, finally steals it, you know, he gets the arrest the moonshiner, takes his car, slaps the sheriff's star on that, and then starts catching up with the moonshiners that way, which is just ultimate no respect. I don't like you at all, Joe Carter, federal agent.
Square.
He's a square,
total,
dude.
Total fucking square.
Meanwhile, with the cool kids, in 1958, Thunder Road got released. Robert Mitchum out there slinging dick in Hollywood, winning car races in the movies. So, of course, it wasn't long before Thunder Road became hugely popular. And it's like, this is all the late 50s is when NASCAR is really starting to kind of, it's not national consciousness yet. It's very regional, but it's starting to get some traction behind it. You know, it's starting to... at least the equipment is starting to progress where it's like, wow, these cars are going pretty fucking fast. The local crowds are getting pretty big. The drivers are getting some measure of local fame. So it's not big level yet, but we're getting there. So, of course, it wasn't long before the question of whose car was fastest began to pop up in small towns throughout the South. And before long, races would be held on dirt tracks outside the towns. In many small southern towns, the Saturday night races became the week's main attraction. it was like the biggest thing in town, like akin to like a Friday night football game these days.
Yeah. And this
Which
is
Texas is huge, but throughout the entire South, I mean, it's like
it's an institution, yeah. And this kind of gives you an idea of the sort of grassroots foundations that the sport really had. And it's crazy because without prohibition, you know, I mean, we would certainly have some form of racing, I think, on a major scale in the United States, but the stock car itself and the uniqueness of American racing is definitely a product of this time period.
Very few sports, like we were talking about that earlier, like I love the stick and ball sports, but there's not many that were made out of, you know, outrunning the law. And so, I love football, but it wasn't really created by outrunning the cops. That's a pretty cool way to start a sport.
Yeah. And just the idea that in these little towns, they would begin gossiping about which bootlegger could beat this bootlegger and that bootlegger and start up these little rivalries that would actually result in holding actual races and selling tickets to them and all that shit is pretty wild.
It probably took about 3 weeks. Like, it probably got
Well, he says he can kick your ass. We'll see about that.
And this was the time, too, where, like, they started making the move away. The popularity started kind of going away from open-wheel racing to stock cars. Stock cars meaning they're, like, you get them, like, off the stock floor. They're obviously highly modified, but it's like a car that you could get if you went to a Ford dealership, let's say, you know, whereas open wheel stock cars have covered wheels. Open wheels are like the today's F1 cars and stuff like that. And we were also talking about how you can totally see picking a side. I've only been a NASCAR fan for a week, and I'm just like, I got no use for open wheel racing. I don't know.
Yeah, these Formula One drivers think they can just date our supermodels and drive around
in here.
Stupid little cars. Well, guess what? That ain't gonna sit well with us.
It's like watching really organized traffic go really fast. It's not that interesting. They're just making a bunch of turns and stuff. I want to see big old stock cars barreling down the straightaway. So until 1950, stock cars, they were restricted to short track racing. Like, we were looking at the some of the dirt tracks that they had on the South Carolina and Florida beaches, and these were almost exclusively dirt tracks. But in 1950, Harold Brazington, a South Carolina businessman and motorsports fan who had been to see the Indy 500, decided that he could apply the same format to a super speedway race, to stock cars. That year, Darlington International Speedway opened in Darlington, South Carolina, and the inaugural Southern 500 was held there, marking the first NASCAR long track all asphalt race, which is a seminal moment. That means you're moving into the big time or away from the sand dirt tracks with clay corners so you can get some better traction to slingshot yourself out of there. We're moving into real deal motorsports territory now.
And if you're going to have the first ever NASCAR race, what better name than the Southern 500?
I mean, come on now. That is genius.
Absolutely.
NASCAR has the same, maybe it's the other way around, but the pro wrestling, what they call like kayfabe mentality, like understanding the product that they're selling and the audience that they're trying to reach and really speaking to the heart of what they're trying to promote. NASCAR is genius, and they've been genius at it since the beginning.
And there's even been rumors that some of the NASCAR finishes and things were scripted, or there's been some rumors about sort of the legitimacy of some of the races, as I guess it will happen. But
right. Which, I mean, like, if it is open to some corruption in that way, but I mean, it just seems like these guys want to go so fast, so bad that it'd be real hard to get one of them to throw a race. But
yeah,
I don't know.
And there are some personalities that I don't see throwing nothing. So
not a damn thing. So it wasn't until 1959 in Daytona, Florida, that the foundations for today's sport of NASCAR were, like, really solidified. It was here that Bill France opened the Daytona International Speedway, a 2.5-mile track with 31-degree turns, which, like, when I, like, really looked at what 31 degrees was, it was like, holy shit. This meant speeds that were previously unreachable were now the norm. This is 135.5-mile-per-hour average. That's not the fastest. That's what they're averaging for the entire race. Three cars finished at the very end. Lee Petty, who was like the patriarch of the famous Petty clan, he was the winner who was announced at the – they announced one guy as the winner. Turns out he wasn't the winner. Lee Petty challenged it, and he was declared the winner later. 41,000 people came out to watch, which is an insane crowd.
Yeah, making –
1959 – just a regional sport.
Yeah, that basically just sprung up organically a decade prior.
A decade ago, right.
You're talking about some serious cash on the line when you're putting 40,000 butts into the seats.
And they had to be real excited about where this was going to go. So throughout the 1960s, the sport continued to grow with the nation's big three auto manufacturers holding sway as NASCAR's biggest promoters. General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Fiat Chrysler Automobiles U.S. are often referred to as the big three, this meaning the biggest three auto manufacturers in the United States. So they were like the manufacturers of all the cars, and until the late 60s, they controlled basically all the sponsorship in NASCAR. It was like a crazy idea that, like, you know, let's say McDonald's would want to sponsor a car, or, you know, the Postal Service or whatever. Anything outside of racing seemed like, well, why would they want to sponsor a car, you know?
Yeah, and the idea also is the races themselves are the advertisements for the big three because, you know, fans of those brands, of those car makers would attach themselves to the drivers of those type of cars
100%.
and take pride. If the Ford would win or the Chevy would break down, or
right? If you're,
the Dodge would start rusting out after 2 years. It's made like a damn hunk of junk.
You think it'd last 2 years?
But I know from a lot of the NASCAR fans that I've worked with, just as much as the drivers, it's the type of car they're driving that they attach themselves to and take pride in.
Yeah, it is much more of a I will say it's much more of a team sport than there's one driver, I get it, but like the entire team, yes, your pit crew and all that, but the organization behind all that does the research and the development of the cars. So the it's not a passive sponsorship role that they were putting into it. Like they were actively developing these vehicles, and it obviously behooved them to make them faster and faster and better, so it was a mutual beneficial relationship. But it didn't. It also kind of capped the growth that NASCAR could get. It was gonna. It bred insularity.
Yeah, and they would. I mean, it was literally a race to see who could advance the most, the fastest, and
right.
Obviously, it's as we know it today, it's a still growing and evolving sport.
But it's still a 200-mile-an-hour billboard, that's for sure. But during the 1960s, this is when we started to get, like, the petties, who are probably, I would say, the most dynastic, the biggest, like, racing dynasty, at least in NASCAR. So Lee Petty was, like, the patriarch to it all, and he was the father to Richard Petty, who... I'm sure if you're familiar with stock car racing at all, you know, Richard Petty. And there are a few more families in American sports, if any, that have held sway to that kind of dynasty. We're talking five decades, something like that.
Yeah, we know. When you think about in major American sports and sort of families who have held sway over – over their sport. I really, you know, we have the Mannings. We have, I don't even know, but I can tell you that as I think through them, you know, obviously in
the Mannings is a pretty good analogy though, because you've got that's not far off. But even then, it's like.
But
if
Peyton's son grows up and wins the Super Bowl, and then his son grows up and wins the Super Bowl, the idea of even, you know, anybody doing what that family did in that sport, it's hard to imagine anybody really coming close to touching them.
And it started all the way back in the 50s, and it's still progressing through the 60s. Other drivers, like we said, not time to get to absolutely everybody, but we're going to pick out some of our favorites here. David Pearson in the 1960s, a huge driver. Joe Weatherly, another great driver in the 1960s. My favorite guy that I found from the 1960s, who raced for decades, but his big shining moment came in the 60s, was Junior Johnson. Junior Johnson had done 11 months for moonshining before winning the 1960 Daytona 500. So they put him away on moonshine charges, and then I think a couple years he was supposed to do 11 months, so he got a 2-year sentence, and he got paroled a couple months before the start of the Daytona 500. So he ends up winning it, learns all the skills on the back road, goes through an entire successful NASCAR career, famous driver. Then in May 2007, Johnson teamed with Piedmont Distillers of Madison, North Carolina, to introduce the company's second moonshine product called Midnight Moon. Johnson became part owner of Piedmont Distillers, the only legal distiller in North Carolina at the time. Midnight Moon follows Johnson's family generation's old tradition of making moonshine, and is available in all 50 states. Every batch is born in an authentic copper still. It is handcrafted in small batches. The Shine is a legal variation of his famous family recipe and is available in 8 varieties that range from 70 to 100 proof. Junior describes his moonshine as smoother than vodka, better than whiskey, best shine ever.
Yeah, he spent his 11 months in the can thinking about how to put his skills to work, and he went legit not only in racing but also
in moonshining. He could have gotten into any other member of business ventures, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to go back to where I started.
Well, stick to what you know. You know what I mean?
Stick to what I know. I don't know nothing about real estate.
You gotta stick with who you brought to the dance. So
ain't no reason to rise above my raising. The 70s, which was okay. Okay, now I'm about to get really fired up. So I'm going to take a second here. Breathe deep. If you've watched, I think it's a Daytona 500 documentary that I've watched like 3 times this week alone. Dale Jr., who's Dale Earnhardt's son, talks about if you could be a race car driver in any time in history, you got to pick the 1970s. And I fully agree. The 1970s brought the sport to a truly national scope, and for the first time, sponsors from outside of the racing world were allowed in as NASCAR became more and more a part of the mainstream sports consciousness. Richard Petty was still if not the top driver, one of the top drivers perennially every year throughout the 70s. Bobby Allison, Cale Yarborough, the Waltrip brothers, all huge throughout the 1970s. And this is when the sport really started to get its legs nationally. It wasn't huge yet, it wasn't mainstream, but at least it was on the radar.
And yeah, this might be the most important decade in the history of the sport. And NASCAR, just like the fight game and fight promotion, is really a personality driven sport. And people attach themselves to, you know, the drivers, and they cheer for that person to win. And so we get a lot of, you know, really famous characters that start to come to us in this time period.
Right. And like, you know, Richard Petty, a famous character. Like I said, we don't have time to write down each and every one. Bobby Allison, another famous character. Carol Yarborough, who we were talking about. There's a Squidbillies episode where Rusty Kyler holds Santa Claus hostage and demands the bones of Cale Yarborough in order to release Santa Claus. I didn't really, I thought that was funny, but I didn't really get how funny it was until I did this episode.
And the,
of course you would want the bones of Cale Yarborough. Makes sense. Who's still alive? It was like, man, that made it 10 times funnier. But the,
yeah.
The documentary we're talking about was about the 21st annual Daytona 500, which is called The Perfect Storm. If you're interested, in NASCAR documentaries, don't worry. There's plenty. This might be the first one I recommend. It's about the 21st annual Daytona 500, really the springboard for NASCAR going national. You watched the documentary. I don't know how fired up it got you. I fucking dug it.
Yeah, it definitely blew away my expectations. Like I said, there was all this content that was just right there available to us that for some reason we hadn't just dug into yet. And, yeah, the 1979 Daytona 500 was covered by CBS Sports, and it was going to be a national broadcast. And there had been this nor'easter storm that had hit, you know, New England and northeastern America. And so there's all these people that were snowed in that day, and there's only three channels back then. And one of the channels had the Daytona 500 on it. So lots and lots and lots of people, millions and millions of people, were getting their first exposure to these characters and this sport. And this was a big gamble. I mean, you could maybe even compare it to what WrestleMania III did for Vince McMahon. And,
yeah, I think that's a really apt analogy comparison. That's dead on, where this was like a make-or-break moment. Lots of things came right up to the wire, and everything at the end came off, and it was a hell of a race. And if you've got any more to say about the documentary, I mean, it blew my mind.
Yeah, and it introduces my favorite racer, and probably your favorite racer.
Not probably. 100%.
My favorite professional athlete now.
My favorite professional athlete of all time. Dale Earnhardt.
Yeah, and he obviously is known as the Intimidator. And there was a great quote that took place where there was just this young, scrappy kid out of North Carolina that was not going to back down to these big names in the sport. He was coming to get his.
No, sir. He ain't backing down for no man.
And the commentator just saw the tenacity and the fearlessness that he drove with. And he said, Dale Earnhardt will not be intimidated.
No, sir.
And we sat back and said, quite the contrary, my friend.
Quite the contrary. He will, in fact, intimidate.
Yeah, there's a nostalgia to this that is wonderful, and we like to use the phrase pure Americana, and it is absolutely that, and it is definitely looking back on a golden age and some changing times, and
I've always respected NASCAR. I always liked it from a distance, but that race in particular was a good. Seeing it live must have been even better if you were in my position in 1979 as a casual outside observer and saw that race. I think you would be a fan from then on, because that was, like I said, it's a character-driven sport. All the characters came in, and it was also kind of orchestrated from above, if you will, with all the weather situations. And everything just came together perfectly. I think the WrestleMania 3 analogy is perfect. And that really launched it into the 1980s, where it got huge. I think the biggest driver and the man to beat in the 1980s was definitely still Dale Earnhardt. But there's Darrell Waltrip, Bill Elliott, Russell Wallace, all coming for him. But let's be honest, the 1980s belonged to the Intimidator.
And the sport that we know today was certainly built on the back of Dale Earnhardt. It had the excitement, the crashes, the speed. It had all of these things, but it needed a true star to take it to another level, to take it to national prominence, to move it from that regional base, which, you know, the Hulk Hogan slamming Andre the Giant moment type of thing where to give it that mainstream appeal. And Dale Earnhardt was the man for the hour, and he definitely captured the imaginations of lots of people, and he's still, I would say, the most beloved driver that there has ever been. I would
say. I think so. Yeah, and this is not like to discount the impact or talent or a legacy of any other drivers, but it's just like, man, it really took off and hit another level. I think it's maybe akin to like Stone Cold Steve Austin, where it just took that attitude at that time to a personality with that much swagger and kind of a angry bravado to him, where it wasn't so much a good old boy as it was a dude out to take heads off. Like
there was this rebellious anti-hero nature to him, where
right
he wasn't here to be, you know, he was just here to get down. He just wanted to go, you know.
He was in it to win it.
Yeah.
A week ago, I had never heard of the 1987 Winston, right? Didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
Now, it's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. So let's talk about the path in the grass. So what happened? Okay,
It wasn't a pass. There was no pass.
It wasn't a pass. Okay, we're going to get that out of the way first. Okay, my own personal experience with this, I sat down and watched like this hour-long race, and or however long it was, and I didn't understand what it was when I was starting to watch it. I was, okay, like this is the race, the pass, and the grass happened. Let's check it out. So I start watching it, and they break down that it's 10 laps for $200,000. I start losing my fucking mind. Like I already know the results to this, right? But I start losing my mind. So they start whipping around the track, and they're just getting after it in these Chevy Monte Carlos, these fucking ripping 80s race cars. And now I'm blanking on the driver who knocked him, who started all this. Like Dale Earnhardt kind of bumps this guy, gets him out of his way. The guy crashes. Earnhardt swoops underneath him, and they go to a caution lap for a couple laps. And then they come back, and do you remember the driver who knocked him into the grass?
Elliot?
Okay, yeah, it was. Okay, so they're coming around the corner, and they're going, 200 miles an hour, and he knocks Earnhardt into the grass, and that would spin out, like, the laws of physics just dictate that your tires don't have anything to grab onto anymore. Like, I looked up other cases where this happened, where guys got driven into the grass, and their cars just shut down. Like, it just fucked them. But somehow, Earnhardt never even lost the lead. He just jumped right back from the grass. It's like a superhero movie. It doesn't even make sense. It's like something like Fast and Furious, but awesome.
Yeah, and Bill Elliott led 121 of the 135 laps that day. They interviewed him in 2016, just this past year.
Did he apologize?
He said he's still mad about it 30 years later. And he said, that was probably the maddest I've ever been, but you just have to deal with it and go on. Well, it sounds like he hasn't actually dealt with
it. Sounds like you haven't done that at all, sir.
Yeah, and he had to go to pit road for a flat tire in the final laps there, and he ended up finishing all the way back at 14.
Well, when you try to intimidate the intimidator, you get intimidated.
Yeah, he...
Well,
you know?
In the interview afterwards, like, it's just, like, classic pro wrestling heel behavior. Like, Earnhardt is really – he's pretty mad at him, but he's also chuckling because he knows that he, like, sent the guy into the wall and that he tried to spin him out and it didn't work. So he's, like – he just loves being a bad guy. You can just tell. It's so awesome.
Yeah. And Earnhardt Jr. said about it that obviously it was really exciting, but he said it was really basic. There was a lot of great racing, but they only ran it for $200,000 back then, which tells you how far along the sport
really
has come. Which, and it's one of those things too where we hear $200,000 and we think that's a shit ton of money, but also you have a crew, you have a team, you have to haul this car, which you have to constantly repair. You have to put it in a semi truck and take it from town to town and all these things. So
just tons and tons of overhead.
But
but still a good chunk of change and a huge win. And that kind of all through the '80s, Earnhardt was definitely the man to beat. But in the 1990s, a new generation of drivers and fans came along because it became a mainstream sport. Now hundreds of thousands of people are showing up for races, and it's not so much Southern regional. I mean, we're both from Central California. It's a rural area, and it's, you know, motorsports are pretty popular there. It's pretty popular in the like desert inland empire area in Southern California. All over the country. It's Texas, obviously. So it became a national sport. Drivers like Jeff Gordon became much more popular. Really exploded on the scene. He's a clean cut, mild mannered Indiana kid, like a real good middle of the road guy, not the average person's idea of a NASCAR driver, which is probably why he got so much hate.
And it really made him palatable to a mainstream audience that I think maybe some of the other drivers would probably look down, you know, up north and out west.
Oh, yeah.
For just being good old boys and Southerners. And we have our perfect heel to come into the mix. And also somebody that, you know, people that might not like the good old boys could identify with and root for.
Right, he's a necessary guy. He's a valuable guy. Like,
yeah,
all the stuff we're saying is tongue in cheek, kind of poking fun at Jeff Gordon. But
also super talented. You know,
absolutely,
really, really fucking good too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of the best ever. Like, let's you know, if you want to look at it, definitely one of the best ever. But he's natural born heel for NASCAR. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, so we have a bunch of guys in the 90s. We had Alan Kulwicki. He was kind of a guy that burst on the scene. He had a title run in 1992. It was nothing short of amazing. Kulwicki was one of the several drivers who entered the season as a real underdog, and he ran his own team and had a major sponsor in Maxwell House in 1991. At one point in the season, Kulwicki found himself trailing in the standings, but with solid finishes, he managed to move up the standings once again. Eventually, points leader Bill Elliott ran into some bad luck, and Kulwicki capitalized on it. And when he won the championship in 1992, it was an example of a small team beating out the bigger teams that were loaded with sponsorships. It was a true underdog story. This guy was going to explode on the NASCAR scene in the 90s, but sadly, Kulwicki died in 1993 when a plane he was riding in crashed 6 miles from its destination. The Leonard Skinner of NASCAR, I guess.
Sadly. Yeah, in every sport has these stories.
But we have a third driver we're going to cover in the 1990s generation.
And I just want to say, just thinking about the huge deal it was to have Maxwell as a sponsorship back then, back when the coffee wars were Maxwell and Folgers.
I was going to say
it was
Maxwell v. Folgers.
Yeah, this is the age before Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts and all this. I mean, not before it, but before the prominence of it. But I remember those gigantic coffee cans of Maxwell and Folgers. That
no disrespect to Alan Kulwicki, but the best part of waking up,
Folgers in your cup.
I'll tell you right now.
And now we're seeing these, we've seen this for a while, but these sponsorships that are coming from all over. It's no longer just
it's
Ford, Chevy.
The ties to racing are tenuous at best.
Now we have
M&M.
Gatorade, Budweiser, Wrangler. Yeah, it you know. it goes, the list goes on and on from
it's a testament to how far they've grown their sport, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So I'll tell you one sponsor, Mountain Dew. I fucking can't stand Mountain Dew. You know who loves Mountain Dew? A guy we're going to talk about next. Well, you know what? Okay. He's part of a big dynasty. He's a legacy. Okay. Dale Earnhardt Jr. I've got him on the list here. Matt, why don't you go ahead and read my number one and number two points for Mr. Dale Earnhardt Jr., if you would, please.
Well, first of all, he ain't his daddy.
Hell no, he ain't.
And second of all, he ain't never will be.
And that is all that you need to know. No, okay. I'm being facetious. He exploded on the scene. Lots of people also didn't like Dale Earnhardt Jr. He seemed like he had a silver spoon in his mouth. He obviously wasn't his dad. Didn't drive like him, didn't have the same attitude. So a lot of people weren't the biggest fans, saw just some nepotism that he got as far as he did. But, I mean, I think he's spoken for himself in his NASCAR career. He's been incredibly successful.
Yeah, and he just retired, so we'd like to wish him well. He had a and if he had the career he had and his name wasn't Earnhardt Jr., he would be
He wouldn't have caught any trouble. Yeah, he'd be everyone.
He'd be praised for having a great career, but he did have a huge legion of followers who were his dad's followers, who many of them followed him and supported him, because as we've seen in this sport, it's really unlike any other in how much success we've had with the sons and grandsons of people.
Right, just being within a family.
As Bo Cephas would say, it's a family tradition.
I mean, Tommy Hank, why do you get drunk? No, I mean, the old guard was still holding strong. Dale Jarrett was still in there. Labontes were still in there. Dale Earnhardt, obviously, all through the 90s. And the 2000s came. This was supposed to be NASCAR was really hopeful at this point. It was on the rise, still growing. Nationally, it was as mainstream at this point as NFL or Major League Baseball would be. It's covered on SportsCenter every night. Like I said, we don't even follow NASCAR, but we're familiar with the drivers' names. We know who these guys are. And I remember in 2001 when we got the news on SportsCenter that Dale Earnhardt had been killed in a crash, and this was a seminal defining moment for NASCAR. During the Daytona 500 on February 18th, 2001, Earnhardt was killed in a three-car crash on the final lap of the race. He collided with Ken Schrader after making small contact with Sterling Martin and hit the outside wall head-on. Earnhardt and Schrader's cars both slid off the track's asphalt, banking into the infield grass just outside of turn four. So it didn't even look like it was that bad of a crash, and it was like 15 or 20 seconds before the very end of the race. But
it was a true tragedy for the sport. Obviously, it sent shockwaves through the sports world in general.
Right.
Yeah,
you
did not need to be a NASCAR fan to know who Dale Earnhardt was. Obviously,
no.
he was the face that runs the place, and he, just awful what happened. And when you see the crash, you've seen crashes like that a lot of times, and
he's seen so much worse where the guy just gets up and hops out and walks away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what happened to Earnhardt, which we're going to talk a little bit about the inherent dangers in the sport and just how dangerous it is. What happened to Earnhardt was what's called a basilar skull fracture. There's been a ton of drivers that have died from this. Formula One drivers Roland Ratzenberger in 1994, he died. Indy 500 driver Scott Brayton, Bill Vukovic, and Tony Bettenhausen all died from basilar skull fractures. And NASCAR drivers, these are just NASCAR drivers alone. Tony Roper, Kenny Irwin Jr., Kerry Schoonover, Grant Adcox. Neil Bonnet, John Nemechek, J.D. McDuffie, Clifford Allison, a member of the Allison family, Dale Earnhardt, obviously a member of the Earnhardt family, and another member of a patriarch or a dynasty family, Adam Petty, who was, I believe, 19. He's a grandson of Richard Petty, all died of basically skull fractures. So this led to the implementation of what's called the Hans device. And I've kind of, like, Matt gets, like, a little bit of an outline of what we're going to talk about, and I've, like, included a picture of the Hans device.
And I just want to add before we get into this, not to make light of these guys and what they went through, but, man, race car drivers have some fucking weird names.
They have some strange names, yeah. these are some of the greatest names that... I mean, you'd have to go back to, like, 1930s poker players to find better names than these guys have.
Yeah, well, and I think, I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about him. Another guy who died tragically in the sport, while not on the track, was, I think, got to be my favorite race car driver name of all time. It was Mr. Dick Trickle.
Dick Trickle, the tragic tale of Dick Trickle. Was that name, did they even understand what that was at the time? Did they not predict that that would eventually become kind of a funny name?
They knew he'd become a star, and they were fucking right, so.
Touché.
Let me ask you this. If your last name is Trickle, what else could you name your son? I mean, really, it's.
Little? Little Trickle?
Little Dick Trickle. Little Dick Trickle. So
sadly, the implementation of the Hans device probably. How did he pass away? How did Dick Trickle pass away?
He passed away a few years ago, and he was having crazy chest pains for several weeks, and they couldn't figure out what was going on with him, and he committed suicide because. I don't know. He was in chronic pain, and I don't know what else was going on. But, yeah, for a hypochondriac like myself, that kind of freaks me out because I'm like, man, what that shit, you know, these incurable crazy things that happen to people. It's, I don't know. Obviously, I don't know if it's related to his career as a race car driver or anything like that, but it's sad nevertheless to lose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah, just a fucking... Cool-ass name, man. I know that.
Well, sadly, the implementation of Hans' device probably wouldn't have helped him out too much, or you. But the Hans' device has been implemented after. I mean, it's you can see a picture of it there if you want to look it up online. It's just like almost like a cowboy collar, if you've ever seen those in football. Does that sound about right?
It looks like some astronaut shit if you...
Yeah, it does.
If you see it, it's got, you know, the helmet, and then, yeah, it comes up around with this sort of spine board looking thing that comes up behind the back of the head, and then it attaches to the driver's suit or whatever it does there.
It's carbon fiber. It's shaped like a big U, but the back of the U set behind the nape of the neck. That's what the description says, not my words. The nape of the neck, the two arms. Lying flat along the top of the chest. So it's like kind of loops over the back of your neck, sits harnessed in the front, but the device is just attached to all itself. So the belt crosses, you'd have to look at it. It's too complex for me to just explain.
It was
secured
a lot of...
to the body of the driver. Big point. It's the body of the driver that it's secured to, not the seat. So the head, like, moves with the body, but it's still secure.
Yeah, and it's basically its primary function is to sort of keep you in place? Or how is this supposed to prevent what happened to Dale Sr. from happening to other people?
It just does, man. It just does. No,
well, I also must say that my favorite part of hearing you give that description was saying the nape of the neck. I felt like you were reading a romance novel there for a second.
It did feel like I was.
You immediately qualified it with, not my words.
Not my words. Not my words.
I want y'all to know that I would never refer to anybody's neck as having any sort of nape or nape-like qualities to it.
But it's just a big, it's a big brace. It like how it actually prevents the vessellar skull fracture, I'm not sure. I think it has something to do with it not being attached to the vehicle itself and being a brace that moves with the body. But that seemed to be the big selling point, or the big like takeaway point from the articles I read. It was like, it moves with the body, so it's not a
well in the
safer in that
the,
way.
The Dale Earnhardt crash put the sport really under a microscope for not, you know, for questions about its safety and ensuring the safety of its drivers.
Right.
Like,
and I mean,
what the NFL
point.
Is going through today.
Yeah, very,
you know,
similar.
Player safety and brain trauma and all these things. This is
a similar problem, because how do you, you can only make it so safe, you know?
Yeah, you're still in a little tin box going 200 miles an hour.
Well, so you're trying to control
left circuit.
Right, you're trying to control all these aspects that are kind of beyond what you can control if you actually want to keep the integrity, let's say, of the sport going, which is a major point of confliction with the restrictor plates, which is, like, I'll be honest, I have a base understanding of what restrictor plates are. I think I went over this briefly before the episode. We get that it's a plate. It attaches to the intake of an engine. It limits the power. It means that the cars aren't going to be able to be too powerful to withstand, their frames aren't going to be too powerful to withstand the speeds that they're able to go, so they won't go like flying off the track. But that's a major bone of contention with fans and drivers, because a lot of people think that it's lame to make the cars go slower on purpose, and a lot of drivers think it's more safe to give them more control over the vehicle.
Yeah, and like you said, it's kind of that debate over what would really be safer, and the regulations sometimes in the best interest might not actually, they might do more harm than good. And let them race.
Let them boys race is what I say. It seems like, okay, the way I was thinking about this from a, you know, someone that doesn't know that much about it, but it's like, well, if all the brain surgeons are telling you that, like, we need this piece of equipment to work, and we can do better brain surgery if you just, like, you know, don't mess with our equipment, then just let them do the brain surgery. You know, like, they're the experts in the world at driving race cars. If they say that they're safer without the restrictor plates, I get that their inclination is always going to want to go faster, and that safety probably isn't always their primary concern, but they're the experts. Like, it is kind of lame to go slower on purpose.
Yeah, and I know you love the opinion of brain surgeons, but
I do. Yeah.
I think this is kind of one of those things where if you're listening to this and you're a fan of NASCAR, you probably know a hell of a lot more about restrictor plates and have a more educated opinion on them than I do. And
right, we could definitely. I can say I am prized by how contentious of an issue it is. It is a very contentious issue in the NASCAR community.
Yeah.
As to whether restrictor plates are helpful or harmful for the racing. But that's just one of the problems that NASCAR is going to face as it goes into the 21st century. It's in the mid-2000s, all up until recently, it's been a booming sport. Like, drivers are still, I mean, probably more so than ever with outside sponsorships and constant commercials and everything. Drivers like Jimmy Johnson, Tony Stewart, Matt Kenseth, they're all household names now. Like, I don't follow NASCAR up till now, but I would have totally recognized all those names before this episode. I would have recognized Kurt and Kyle Busch as the dudes from SportsCenter who I don't like. I don't know if you have any take on those guys.
You know, those damn pretty boy Bush fellers.
I tell you, dude.
I'm most familiar, I would say, with Jimmy Johnson, who seems to just be a juggernaut, multi-time champion. The guy seems to just have it licked, and he stays in that winner's circle, and he's you know, as a technician and just a badass driver. And also, I would say, Mr. Tony Stewart, famously driving the iconic number 20 Home Depot car.
What did you call him? You say he's what?
Well, he is
old school wild.
He's old school wild, man. He is a throwback to the glory days of NASCAR. He will get in your face.
I love it.
He races like his hair's on fire, and
he really does. And I didn't get that before doing this episode, but it's like you start to see the. I thought it's just cars going fast, you know, but it's like no, you see these guys' personalities come out and how they drive, and you're like, Tony Stewart, he's old school wild now.
Yeah, he. You know, he's always on SportsCenter and everything for ready to throw down, getting in people's faces, fighting, whatever. And you know, there are some sports where, you know, you're going to have fights. And when you're driving, you know, I like to think about it as if I'm driving 45 miles down the road and somebody cuts me off, I get hot.
Pisses you off, yeah.
So if I'm driving 180 miles an hour, and we're trading paint, heading into the turn, and
for millions of dollars.
And so, and you could die, you know. You can, you know, if somebody dicks around, that could be it for you, and it could cost you a shitload of money in your car and everything else. But
cost people their jobs. You know, it's are high.
And you're racing for a shitload of money and.
Can't blame a guy for his temper.
So yeah, obviously road rage is going to be a part of that. And when you got a guy like Tony Stewart who drives like a bat out of hell and gets after it, and that's the personality that I think is great for the sport.
Yeah, I think even, you know, just getting into it, it's like that is one of the guys I'm looking forward to going back and watching more races of his. And he's guys that have been around for years, and I feel like I did a disservice now not keeping up with it, but I'm excited to go back and kind of check out their catalog of work. I'm late to the game, but all through the mid-2000s, NASCAR was regarded as one of the world's fastest-growing sports. It's still on the rise. Millions are on the line every week. Millions of dollars, millions of people tuning in. Billions of dollars are being poured into advertisement and development. The best engineers, the best mechanics, the best human performance specialists, and the best financiers in the world are propelling the sport forward. And NASCAR can, in many ways, seem a world away from the back roads moonshining roots. However, even with today's big money and bright lights, the concept is still the same as it was on those moonlit nights in the Carolina Hills. It pays to be fast.
Sure, shit does. And on your point about how fast NASCAR has grown and is growing, it's second only to the National Football League in TV viewerships. And when you think about it, you know, there's a ton of different football games and different things going on each week. But with NASCAR, you know, there's the big race. You know, they have their other events and their other circuits and the other things they put on throughout the race week and the weekend.
There's one big NASCAR race.
But that's the big race. And
right.
If you're a fan of NASCAR, that's what you're watching each and every week. It's the one thing that you got to tune in for. And so as we kind of get into the NASCAR offseason now, we're just about a couple months away when they'll be starting their engines down in Daytona and getting it kicked off, right?
I mean, 9 days ago I wouldn't have cared, and now I'm fired up for this upcoming season. my dad works with a guy who every year he would take time off for the Daytona 500. And so, like, after, like, 5 or 6 years, you know, I'm going to take this time off for the Daytona 500. Okay, cool. And he was, like, asking him about how Daytona was. And the guy was like, well, how would I know how Daytona is? You know, like, I have no idea. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, no, I take the time off and I watch it at home. But he took the time off.
Oh, yeah.
To sit there and watch the race at home.
But it's on a Sunday, and it's like,
yeah, he took like a Friday off or whatever to watch the time trials or something like that.
Yeah, and on February 18th, 2018, they'll be back down there and getting after it again. And, you know, obviously not having Dale Jr. will be interesting, you know. And, yeah, it's a crazy, crazy, crazy sport. And there's so many huge tracks around the country that it's really – something that I would want to check out just for the experience of it, not having been a fan and not having known. Yeah, I think exposure to the sport would, you know, it's one of those things where, especially if you experience it live, it would be some crazy shit to see, and it could definitely draw you in and make a fan out of you.
I don't think I had, once my kind of understanding increased of what's going on here, like 31 degree turns and 200 plus mile per hour races, it's like once you put all that into context and you realize what you're watching, it is, man, there's nothing else like it. It's incredible.
And just to kind of give you an idea of how big these speedways are and these tracks are, the Tennessee Volunteers played Virginia Tech back in, I think it was 2016, and it was a 153,000 feet Bristol Speedway.
Holy shit.
So, you know, the big house in Michigan and all these crazy massive football stadiums.
How many seats do they have for reference?
Oh, close, about 110,000, somewhere thereabouts.
Yeah.
And yeah, just dwarfed by the Bristol Speedway.
40,000 more people. I mean, it's insane. It's earned every inch of its way up on the climb. But you know what? Like I said, I feel bad for all the lost time that I have not being a NASCAR fan, but I am now, and this was definitely worth cutting an episode on. I had a blast doing it. Hope you learned a lot. I had a blast too.
I loved it, and I'm trying to think of what the hell we can do next week to top the excitement that was studying this and digging into it.
It's going to be tough, but we'll figure something out. But we
hell
want to
yeah.
thank you again for tuning in to this episode of Back, Back, Back. Be sure and tune in next week, and we'll be back with the craziest stories in sports. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.
Peace out.